All right. I was supposed to make the announcement that there is no dance, you know, men's dance class this afternoon. However, at 5:30, there will be a class on how to properly use a pink spray can. Okay, so and for those of you who don't know how to work those things, we'll learn how to do that. I'm going to cut right to the chase. I'm going to be addressing the issue of Paul, the apostle. I'm going to do as many excerpts out of this series as I can, because Paul, once again, not that it's never happened before, is under fire, being accused of all these kinds of things. The name of the series is actually called Paul, False Apostle, or Falsely Accused. And so I want to go through the background of these things, because the focus I'm going to have on this, which you're going to continue in part two tomorrow, is two different ways of thinking in the first century. These are two words that have a meaning. We will define them tomorrow, or maybe today if we get into it. But they are also two different ways of thinking in the first century, from a halakhic point of view and from an agadic point of view. We all know that there's a difference between Western thinking, Greek, and, if you will, biblical thinking, Hebrew or Semitic, so forth. There's a huge difference between those thinking processes, but there's also a difference in the Hebraic way of thinking in the first century as well. And I hope to give you the background of Paul on this, because one of the things that that I believe is unique about Messianics or Hebrew roots or whatever we call us, kind of thing, and I'm tired of saying that, aren't you? Is that we find a multitude of ways to divide ourselves. I mean, we have great imaginations. Some of you know what I'm talking about. We come up with some of the most bizarre ways to create another denomination or another sect or divide ourselves or to split up and so forth. And so the whole issue of Paul is also just another reason for someone to say, well, I'm going to go off and start my own anti-Paul church. Okay? And so we're constantly doing these kind of things. So my message actually, with respect to Paul, is once again, unity. To bring people together, because we find unique ways to do things. I mean, even with just the issue of the Torah. Some of you know what I'm talking about. Just the issue of the Torah alone. We've got God dissected like a frog in a biology lab. We got all kinds of his people scattered all over the place. We have people that believe, well, you know, this group of God's people over here, you have to keep all the commandments. And this group of people over here, you only have to keep like 7 of them. Okay? And this group of people over here, you don't have to keep any of them. And this bunch over here, you can keep them if you want to, but you don't have to keep them if you don't want to. Sound familiar? We got God, and no wonder we have a little division going on out there, because that's what we do with people, is we split them up all over the places. My personal opinion that we are doing the same thing, for example, with the Constitution of these here United States as we've done with the Torah. We're doing the same thing. I would not be surprised if, this is not a prophecy, but I'd not be surprised if the Messiah tarries, if by the year 2020, for example, that our Constitution is not in the Library of Congress, but it's in the Smithsonian Institution. It's an old historical relic that we charge $6 for adults and $4.50 for kids to go in and look at and go, look at that. That used to be, okay, the foundation of our country, whatever. And so it's going to be in some museum somewhere. Because we're dividing ourselves up all the time. We're doing the same thing with the Constitution, and we get divided when we do those things. When someone comes up to me, for example, and says something like this, is the Torah for us today? My response is, I don't know. Is breathing for us today? Is eating food and drinking water, is that for us today, or is that only for Jews? Okay? Because religious men, in my opinion, is that religious men have no concept of what the Torah is. To them, and the way it's dominantly taught, it's just a set of rituals and ceremonies given to a group of people over here so they'll look different from this group of people over here. God gave these rituals and ceremonies. There's no rhyme or reason to any of these things. He just gave them to them so they'll look different from the Jehovah's Witnesses, okay, or the Buddhists or the Hindus and so forth. And so they're just rituals and ceremonies, and God has no rhyme or reason for them. He just gives them out to us to see if we'll actually be devoted enough to actually do it. Look down upon his people and go, look there. They really did put a lamb on the altar. They really do. Look, they really are doing that. Okay? There's a purpose to all of these things. Is there anybody in here that can agree with me on that? That our God is not a flippant God. Our Creator and our Redeemer isn't out there winging it every day and so forth and changing back and forth. Evolution, okay? He's a God that works in cycles, teaching His children the same thing over and over and over. And one of those concepts, I remember, speaking of keeping the Torah, I remember a few years, actually it's been a year and a half or something, I was speaking in Bakersfield, California. And I was at a very large auditorium, and I was right in the middle of a series called The Earth is Filled with Violence, as if to say why the earth is filled with violence. I'm about 2 hours into it when a guy in the back of the room jumps up, and it's still as clear as my mind as can be. This is exactly the way he said it. He said, "So you keep all 613 commandments?" And I said, "No, I don't have a menstrual cycle." And he misunderstood, because he's been classically trained by the Western religious systems. He's been classically trained to look at the Torah, look at the commandments with those kind of glasses on. But see, that actually disheartened me at the time, because I'm not there. I realized that the people in the auditorium, it took 10 minutes to calm them down. You calm down in about 20 seconds. But that place took 10 minutes to get everybody to settle down, okay? And so the reality is, they weren't laughing with him, they were laughing at him. And that was a knee-jerk reaction of mine, and I embarrassed that man. And so I said, "Excuse me, sir, I'd really appreciate it if you would stay afterwards so we can talk." And he did. And we pull him aside, and I said, "The problem is you've been classically trained on what keeping the commandments means. You've been trained to think, just like I was, just like many of us were, that when you see the phrase 'keep the commandments,' in your mind that means they keep all 613 commandments. That's the way we're trained to think. And so they're thinking, if I can find one you don't keep, gotcha." Okay? And so they'll usually bring up, "Do you stone your rebellious child?" and something. Okay, so usually bring up something like that. Figuring that, you know, if you don't keep them all, you shouldn't keep any of them. That kind of thought process. It's like living in a town where four fires break out and you only have two fire engines. So since you can't put out all the fires, well, we just won't put out any of the fires. Okay? It's that kind of thinking that we do. And so I explained to him, I said, "Keep the commandments is something that's revealed. The meaning of that phrase is revealed, guess where? In the beginning. Because everything is revealed in the beginning. Why? Because God so loved the whole world. Not just people from Acts chapter 2 on. But He loved the whole world from the beginning. So He gives these truths from the beginning. And through the stories of Abraham and Noah and Samson, all those things, He teaches the same things to His children over and over and over again. Because He's a kind, loving God. And He wants His children to know these things. So He reveals them in all these stories, biblically from the very beginning. And so all things are revealed there. And so I told him that keeping the commandments is seen when Adam is told to till the garden. Till, shamar, okay? Shem mem resh. Same word translated as keeping everywhere else, and sometimes observing, is translated as Adam taking care of the garden. So Adam is given a commandment, take care of the garden. So the idea of shamar means to guard, to watch, to protect, to take care of it. So why is it Adam's transgression? When you're watching and taking care of it, you don't let a serpent into the garden. Okay? So this is why it ends up being Adam's transgression and the woman's deceit, because Adam was supposed to guard it and protect it. This is one of the things I see in our Constitution. The Constitution of the United States is a document, a founding document produced by fathers, early fathers who produced this document, and they have taken care of it. They watched over it. They protected it. They put it in the Library of Congress. They surrounded it with laser beams, and they put bulletproof glass around it. Why? To keep it away from Nicolas Cage. Okay, but that's another story, okay? But some of you are going, "Nicolas who?" So thank goodness we have people that had the wherewithal to maintain that document, and somewhere in the middle, like the late 1800s, didn't decide, "Well, let's just do away with this. This has all been done away with. Abraham Lincoln, it's been all been done away with." Okay? Thank goodness we have that document, because we need the Supreme Court to interpret the Constitution for us, but they have to have something to interpret from. And so we keep it. So we do that with the Constitution. We just don't do it with the Torah, with the commandments of God, for some reason. And so I wanted to lay the background of the whole Paul thing by telling you a riddle. I'm going to tell you a riddle. Now, some of you have probably heard this riddle, went around the internet for a while, a couple years ago. It kind of goes like this. Three men check into a motel. And they all pay $30 for one room. They each pay $10 each for the room. After a while, the clerk realizes he's made a mistake and that the room is actually only $25. So he calls the bellboy and gives him $5 to take to the men. On the way there, the bellboy scratches his head and goes, "How am I going to divide $5 between three guys?" He says, "I know what I do." He takes $2 and puts it in his pocket, and he gives each of the men back $1 each. Now those men who originally paid $10 each got back a dollar. So now those men have paid $9 each for the room. 9 times 3 is 27. The bellboy put $2 in his pocket. That's 29. Where's the missing dollar? Now, we've only got one session, so we haven't got time to really ponder this for a while. Okay? The reason why I wanted to bring this up, because I want to say that, first of all, everything, every detail I gave you in that little pair, in that little story or riddle was the truth. There's no lies in there. There's no, not even necessarily any advertising gimmicks such as baiting and switching and so forth, which we do in the Hebrew Roots movement to each other, by the way. But that's another whole teaching. All those things were the truth. The reason why there appeared to be a contradiction, the reason why there appeared to be a problem with it, is because of the way I told you the riddle. It's the way I told it. And because of the way I arranged it when I put it together, your conclusion is there's something wrong, is there's a contradiction. Many times we do that as teachers. We have to be so aware of that, right, Dean? And we have to be aware of our responsibility as teachers in this walk, because sometimes people's lives, I hate to sound like Jack Nicholson, okay? You can't handle the truth, whatever, okay? Sometimes people's lives are at stake. What we do is very serious, and James chapter 3 verse 1 tells us that we have a greater accountability than non-teachers do. Why? Because we have the ability to deceive more people than the non-teachers do. The non-teachers only have the ability to deceive a few people, okay? But the teachers have the ability to deceive a lot, so we better take what we say and what we do very seriously. And that's the biggest problem with this walk right now, is that we're a little unorganized and we don't have any accountability. Can I get an amen to that? I'm not pleading for amens. I'm just saying I want you to know. I want to know that you understand what I just said. We don't have an accountability. So we need to start having accountability with each other on a smaller level, not on a national or international level. Let's start small, if you will. And so we have this great responsibility. So sometimes people can arrange the teaching of Paul, wink, wink, hint, hint, in such a way that it appears like Paul contradicts the Torah. That's going to be my premise as we begin these things. Because it's the way you've been led to think. I remember that there was a sociology experiment and a sociology class at Oxford University in the 70s, back when they didn't have DVDs and CDs, and they're showing 8mm, you know, films or whatever to the class. And the professor shows a 6-minute clip. And he turns to his students, maybe some of you have heard this, this is well known, okay? Turns to his students and says, "I'm going to show you a clip of a dance. There's a camera up on the ceiling and people are in a dance in a ballroom. And I want you all to count how many times the guy with the white shirt, how many people he dances with. I want you to count how many people he dances with." So they roll the 6-minute film, and when they're done, there's all kinds of opinions, as you can imagine, on how many people the man with the white shirt danced with. There was all kinds of conclusions. And then the man turns to the class and he says, "How many saw the 9-foot gorilla walk through the middle of the room?" No! No way! No way! So he rolls the film again, and right through the middle of the room walks a 9-foot gorilla. Now, why did nobody see it? Because they were set up not to see it. So they didn't see it because they had already moved them in this direction so they would not see these things, okay? And that's going to be some of the foundation of my defense of Paul. I believe he's severely misunderstood and I think he's wrongfully accused. Let me start out with a couple other examples before we get into the details of this. In Hebrew thinking, you know the people that wrote the Bible? In Hebrew thought, contradiction is not a problem. They don't have a problem with contradictions. They see it as an opportunity to have dialogue and discussion. As a matter of fact, I can take it even further, quoting Avraham Heschel and wonderful people like that, in my opinion. Raphael Hirsch, people like that. Very balanced people who see that alleged contradictions always have a blessing in them somewhere. They always find somewhere in something that appears to be a contradiction. But see, Greeks were trained to look for contradiction. Western thought were trained to find as many problems as we possibly can. And that's one of the problems with this Hebrew roots walk as well, is that we got the internet now, and now everybody in the world has a platform. And all the people that used to be only able to yell at their dogs in the backyard, okay, and preach to their wives once in a while, now have a platform to say whatever they want to say and not be held accountable for it. And so the way for many people to get the foot in the door is come up with something new and exciting that nobody ever thought of before on planet Earth. Well, get used to the fact that there really ain't nothing new under the sun here. And I still don't think we got the things that we already know down very good, much less coming up with new stuff to throw into the mix. And so it becomes very confusing sometimes. And so once again, they don't have a problem with contradictions. Greeks thinking has a problem with contradictions. And many times it's the way they told the story. I'm going to propose something to you. Because we have several parts of our body that teach that you can keep the commandments if you want to, but you don't have to keep them if you don't want to. Now that's based upon a premise that there are people in the Bible who have to keep the commandments. Name one person in the Bible that has to keep the commandments. See, nobody has to keep the commandments. That's what separates us, people, humans, biological entities, from rocks. Okay? And trees and dirt. Okay? We are given the sovereign ability to choose. None of us human beings have to keep the commandments. And so that whole statement about you can keep them if you want to, you don't have to keep them if you don't want, is based upon the premise that there is somebody that has to. Nobody has to. Everybody has the ability to choose to thumb their nose at God or follow Him to the best of our ability. And so one of the popular sayings, because I've said it all the time is too, is, well, you know, we don't have to keep the commandments. We want to keep the commandments, right? I mean, that's kind of the things that we kind of say to, well, I want to keep the commandments. Well, what happens if you don't want to? What happens if all of a sudden there's a wind one day? Well, I just don't think I want to keep the commandments today. Okay? Now, I'm going to propose a third possibility. Is keeping the commandments have to? Is keeping the commandments because you want to? Or is keeping the instructions of our Father the right thing to do? To sit back and say, is this the right... Is our Father smart enough in the beginning to speak forth commandments that transcend time? Man doesn't have the ability to do that because we're changing all the time because of evolutionary thought rather than creation thinking in the beginning. That God put all the truth in the beginning and He said, now every living thing go forth and multiply after itself. That's a clear way of saying that I gave all the truth. I did everything just exactly the way it should be. My work is perfect. Deuteronomy chapter 32. His work is perfect. And then He says to all living things, go forth and multiply. His word is living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword. The same way. It's living. It's biological, if you will. And they multiply after themselves. So He gives all the truth in the beginning. He says, pass these things down to your children. Why? So then the last generation sees the same truths as the first generation. And if the end is revealed in the beginning, then you'll understand the end. However, If in between the beginning and the end, Mike, you start to change stuff, then the last generation sees a different truth than the first generation. And we wonder why everything is a mess. The fathers constantly, and I know I'm preaching to the choir in a lot of this, but there's a huge difference between change and restoration. Our Father is always in the business of restoring. That is a cyclical word. And when you restore something, it's supposed to look like it was before it came into corruption. If I'm going to restore a Cadillac, when I get done, I don't have a Volkswagen. Okay? I have what I started with. And the Father has to take us through a process. It took us a long time to wander away from Him. And He's patient enough, if you will, to realize that it may take a while for us to turn around, okay, to Teshuvah, okay, and go back to where He had us in the very first place. This passage right here, 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 1 and 2, I chose this one because this particular passage is the quintessential representation of what the Father taught from Genesis chapter 1 on. And Paul teaches it as well. And there's some others that I could quote in Paul's writings, but I chose this one. Because in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, if Paul would have simply said, "Be ye followers of me," then a lot of these accusers of Paul got a good point, Mike. They got a good point. Hey, the Bible's telling us to follow Paul now. So hey, let's forget this Yeshua stuff. Because Yeshua said, "Take up your tree and what? Follow me." Now, once again, little kids understand that. What's wrong with the adults? A child knows what it means to follow someone. I remember when I was young. My father, I'm from Missouri, by the way. I'm from the Boot Hill area. Cape Girardeau, Jackson, everybody knew the Limbaughs, you know. We all know who they were. And I'm from that area. And we were diehard St. Louis Cardinal fans. Okay, I still am. I just have no time to keep up with, you know, this sport idea or whatever, with this distracting sport thing. Okay, I have no time to keep up with it. We were diehard fans. We knew everything about them. My father desperately wanted. By the way, can I say something? My parents are going to be here Sunday. Rarely are they able to, because of the fact that I'm, you know, not in the States much anymore, but rarely are they able to see me and be at something like this. And so I'd appreciate it if those of you see them, just really be nice and cordial, and I'd appreciate that if you coddled them a little bit. My parents don't quite understand this walk. They're very proud of their son, okay? But they still have no clue, you know? Some of you know some people like that, perhaps. They still have no clue what's going on with Brad, okay? But they're moving out of the "he's trying to be a Jew" thing. They are moving away from that, okay? At least now they're saying "he's trying to be an Israelite." Okay, some of you know what I'm saying, okay? And so my father desperately wanted to play ball for the St. Louis Cardinals. But he failed. He didn't make it. And so then he tried to live vicariously, if you will, through me. So I remember he comes into the room. I'm 8 years old. And he walks in the room. He's got a bat and a ball and a glove. And he says three things to me. He says, "Bud," his little term of endearment for me. He says, "Follow me." Now, as a kid, I knew exactly what that meant. That meant I'm going to do what he does. He's going to show me how to hold the bat, and I'm going to hold the bat that way. He's going to show me how to slide into second, and I'm going to slide into second that way. And of course, that's why I didn't become a professional baseball player either, okay? I paid too close attention to my dad, okay, which didn't work for me very well. But the point being is kids know what to do. That's why we come into the kingdom as little children, because they realize that the Word of God becomes flesh and dwells among us, and I believe that with my whole heart unashamedly, okay? And that He kept the Sabbath, He kept the festivals, He ate what was clean, you know the whole story. And then He said to us, if you will, "Follow me." Halakha. Okay? In Hebrew, halakha. Follow after me, which means do what I did, because halakha focuses on what you do. Agadah focuses on where those things come from here, and we will talk about that tomorrow. And so, what does that mean? What does it mean for a child? Well, a child knows if my dad goes, Then the child goes. It's not rocket science, okay? To follow dad means if dad's going like this, I don't go like this. I do it. That was stupid, wasn't it? It's part of my nature, okay, to be a little stupid. But that's what a child understands. So over centuries, we're doing the opposite things that he's doing. Even the whole shadow of things to come. Okay? But these commandments of God, the meat, the holy days and so forth, these are shadows. Well, the shadow doesn't do something different than the body does. If the body's playing tennis, the shadow's not bowling. Okay? If the body of Yeshua is playing tennis, the shadow's playing tennis too. Guess what? Okay? And so, but we've got a teaching out there that the shadow's doing something different than the body does. Okay? We're doing something different now. We're behaving this way. We're behaving that way. We're doing these things. And that's the problem. Going back to this passage, it's just an example of what I believe is in the scriptures over and over and over again. And as I said in the Midrash last night, from my perspective, if something in the scripture is important and it's from God, then it's everywhere. It's everywhere. You don't not only see it everywhere in your text, but you see it growing out there in the field. You see it in the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees and so forth. Because that's where our Father embedded the meaning of biblical words. In those simple little things of creation. Knowing that those things are not endowed with choice. So lemons will always produce what? Lemons. Unless man comes along. You let the natural creation do what it's designed to do, and daffodils will produce daffodils, okay? It's only when men come along and tweak with it and mutate it and mess with it that you get hybrids, GMOs, okay, mutations in biological entities. Men mess with it, okay? God designed things in the beginning, and when he was done, he said, "It is good." Remember? And then after 6 days, he said, "It is very good." Okay, tov miod, very good. The problem is that word good is an abstract word in Western cultures, and it means different things to different people. And so people come to different conclusions on what it means for something to be good because it's abstract. The concept of tov in Hebrew is something that's complete. It's just the way he designed it. That's why when he was done with the day, he said, "It is good." That means I know what I'm doing. I designed it just the way it should be. Humans, leave it alone. Everything will be okay. Just let it do what it's designed to do. And then when he was done with the 6 days, he says, "Not only good is, but it's very good." But see, good means different things to different people, especially in the United States. We use the same word to describe chicken soup as we use to describe God. Okay? I love chicken soup. I love God. So we love God as much as we do chicken soup, apparently. Okay? And so this is what causes, this communication, this words that causes divisions and arguments and fussing and debates between all of us. When Paul is reiterating something here that's taught in the natural creation as is revealed in the opening chapters of Genesis, theologically as well. Because the words of God created everything in the universe. So Paul, once again, did not say, "Be ye followers of me." He said, "Be ye followers of me, even as I also am of Messiah. And now I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things and keep the ordinances as I deliver them unto you." So what Paul is simply saying is this. Yeshua did everything the Father told him to do. Remember, he finishes the whole event by saying, "Telestai" in Greek. "Kala," I believe. In Hebrew, "It is finished." Okay? So, he, as a matter of fact, he says many times in the red words, so we know it's Yeshua because the words are in red. Okay? He says several times, "I do all things that my Father had told me to do. I say all things the Father told me to say." So Yeshua followed the Father. Why did he have to do that? Because that was the evidence of being a true prophet. Remember? You don't lead people after other gods and so forth. So of course he's going to do all things the Father said. And then Paul followed Yeshua. And then Paul says, "Follow me as I follow the Messiah." That's the whole bottom line. Now, that's just a way of saying halakha. I'm going to do. I'm talking about action. Because those two words, as we're going to get into tomorrow, not words that just mean something, and they indeed do, and we will go through the details of that, but they're two different ways of thinking. This is replete throughout Talmudic literature as well. So I wanted to give you that example before we move on. Here's some of the accusations. Obviously, we're not going to be able to go through all these, but I'll go through as many as I can in the time that I have, because the series deals with as many as I can get in the series as well. And there are a lot of accusations against Paul. 90% of them, maybe a little more than that, are something that's not new. Same old things you've been hearing for a long time. Quite frankly, and I'll give some examples here, there are a couple of them because of the internet that are kind of new. Oh, I never thought of that alleged contradiction before. Okay, so let's get into as much as we can. First of all, he's accused of being a false apostle. And there's a source for all these things. I hesitate publicly to say what the source is because I don't want to point the fingers at anybody. But the reason why I did the Paul series, not that the whole world's been waiting for Brad to comment on this, okay? But I did the Paul series because I wanted to give my little flavor to all this kind of stuff. But because for a long time I was inundated with emails and letters from people hearing these things and not knowing how to deal with it. Okay, not knowing how to answer these accusations. And so in my ministry for the past 30 years, I've had something over here, something Paul did over here. So I decided to collect them all into one place, if you will. And so the source of this, one of the main sources of these accusations is from a book that deals with calling, first of all, a whole chapter on why Paul is a false apostle. The main evidence they give, believe it or not, is in Revelation chapter 2, verse 2. In which we have a letter written to the Ephesians, written to the community or the assembly in Ephesus, and they are commended, if you remember, for exposing false apostles. He commended them for that. So here's the conclusion, the thought process. Well, let's see. Paul's the only one who wrote a letter to the Ephesians. So therefore, Paul's the false apostle, as referred to in the letter to the Ephesians by Yeshua in Revelation chapter 2, verse 2. Now, I know a lot of people deal with the apostle issue. There's a lot of people that believe that there are no more apostles, that there was only the first 12 apostles, and that's something that's not going on today, which leads me to wonder why in the world then would you warn people of false apostles? I mean, if that were true, wouldn't you just say, Mike, beware of apostles? Maybe I think weird. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe it's me. Okay? But that is their evidence. And that's not even something worth pursuing because there's a whole lot more here to do. I'm just going to get as many as I can. Then a little while later in another place, as if the right hand sometimes doesn't know what the left hand is doing. And as teachers, we always have to be careful of that. Okay? They say that actually they give a whole half of a chapter based upon Paul's not even qualified to be an apostle. They try to prove that Paul's not even qualified to be an apostle, which once again, you know, leads me to wonder, how can he be accused of a false apostle if he's not even qualified to be an apostle? Okay, but their evidence is in Acts chapter 1, verses 20 through 26. And I go through all the details in the series, and I'm just going to sum it up here now. Acts chapter 1, verses 22 to 26, if you remember the context, if you remember the passage, this is when Judas has bit the dust, okay? Judas has bit the dust, you know, probably hanged himself, fell out, held a craggly rock, guts busted out, blah, blah, blah. You know the whole story. And so they're replacing Judas. And so everything you read in those passages is assumed when you enter, okay, eisegesis rather than exegesis, try to put information into the text, trying to prove to people that those passages are the qualifications for an apostle. And no, they are not. Those passages are qualifications for the replacement of Judas. That's specifically what the chapter is all, or those verses are all about, is the qualifications to replace Judas. He needed to be an eyewitness of Yeshua's resurrection. Why? Because those 12 apostles really are the foundation, okay, of where this restoration, okay, is going to begin. They are part of it. And that's why, that's what you do when you have a building and foundations. They scrawl and write the names in the foundations. Those who were who were known at the time to be the kings and the priests and the religious leaders and so forth. They'd actually write their names, okay, in the foundations and the walls when they would build these buildings and so forth. So hence Revelation, you know, the walls of the apostles and the gates of the 12 tribes and so on and so forth. Okay, moving on. He's also called the man of sin. These accusations is that Paul is the man of sin, the son of perdition, the Antichrist. Based upon 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, which is their verse that they accuse him with, Paul is the man of sin. Now, you can imagine probably my first thought about this is that, well, Paul wrote 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. So that kind of gets me thinking there a little bit. But they have an answer to this. Oh, yes, they have an answer. The answer is Paul, in his letter to the Thessalonians, is actually revealing himself through this man of sin. That's their answer. Okay? That Paul's actually revealing himself, and that he's the one that's the actual man of sin. Another example is the conflicting stories in the book of Acts of his conversion. This is another accusation. In other words, the accusation is this: Paul is a liar. And some of you know what I'm talking about, okay? Some of you have read these things. Get on the internet for a few minutes. There's millions of them, okay? Paul is a liar. One of the pieces of evidence that Paul is a liar is that when you read the story of his conversion in the book of Acts, which is told three times, and how do we know it's in red? It's one of the very few passages in red in the book of Acts. In each one of those conversions, Paul says one time that he saw something but didn't hear anything. And another example, here's something, he didn't see anything, which I don't have time, but that can easily be answered in the Greek structure of those passages. We're not going to do that here. But here's the point I want to make. According to every well-known commentator, Bible scholar, textual critic of the New Testament that I know of, including some people that that Lee Miller put up there, Bruce Metzger, okay, F.F. Bruce, some of the well-known ones. According to every New Testament historian that I know of, virtually, they all agree that Luke wrote the book of Acts. Not Paul. Luke wrote the book of Acts. So, if anybody's lying, who is it? It's Luke. Luke's the one that penned it, okay? So now we got Luke a liar. So that means we got to throw the book of Acts out, which would logically mean that what else would have to go? The Gospel of Luke, okay? Now, let me tell you what this is called. When people see an alleged contradiction in Scripture, this is the way it's generally dealt with. Find an apologetic way to prove that that should have never been in the text in the first place. That's the way we're all trained to do these things. I call that American Medical Association theology. Now what I mean by that, and I mean no offense to the 17 doctors that got up and went that way. Can I stop and ask, is everything okay? Is everything okay? All right, hallelujah. Bless God. Yeah, let's thank Him. Thank you, Father, whatever it was. You had the wherewithal to answer prayer. Thank you. Praise you. And all glory goes to you. So no offense to doctors, but the reality is that most doctors in this country are trained by the system, the American Medical Association. Not all of them belong to the American Medical Association. But many doctors are trained in this country that when there's a problem, there's a contradiction. Remember the riddle? Okay? When there's a problem, when there's a seeming contradiction with you and your body, when you go to them, they're basically trained to do two things. Give you some drugs. Come on, tell me I ain't right. Okay? Give you some chemicals to numb yourself up and go away so I can get the next one in here at $45 an hour, whatever. Or $45 a visit. If it was $45 an hour, that'd be cheap. Okay, you know what I mean. Okay? Bring the next one and give them some drugs, numb the come out, forget it about it for a while. And if that doesn't work, what's step number two? Open it up, remove it. Take that sucker right out of there. Just get it out of there. Okay? In other words, we don't want to get to the source. We don't want to get to the source. We want to take the time, because it used to be a century ago, there was something wrong with you, your town doctor. See, the exile has a lot to do with the chaos in our country and in our world, even in this walk right now. It's because of the exile. Because it used to be, not too long ago, that your doctor was not somebody in a high tower in the big city, but he lived in your town. He lived down the street and he knew you and he knew your kids. And he knew your kids' kids. And when there was something wrong with you, he came over with a little black bag. He came over to your house. And he sat down and he spent the time, okay, to go through things to get to the source. But now we just run them in and out like Walmart, okay? In and out. And that's not necessarily the doctor's fault. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying the tendency is when there's something wrong, just to remove it out of there so we don't have to deal with it. Well, how convenient. That is intellectual laziness, in my opinion. It's intellectual laziness. I think we need to be men. Okay, I'm giving you my opinion. Please don't stone me. I think we need to be men. I include women. Okay? And get to, and come together to solve these problems. That's the problem. We don't do that anymore. Okay? We're all out doing our own thing. And this is something you may not agree with either, but I'm going to say it anyway. I am absolutely convinced that Brad Scott does not know everything. I am absolutely convinced of that. And I'm sure 90% of you are as well. But I am convinced, since we are the body of Yeshua, that all of us together, we do know a whole bunch. But does the enemy know that? Do you think the bad guy knows that if we're together, we're dangerous? You think he knows that if we come together, the jig is up for him? Okay? And so what does he do? He does everything he can to separate us and divide us in a myriad of ways. And now he's working with us through the internet so we can come up with imaginative ways. You know how many denominations in the world? I just read this statistic not too long ago. There's over 37,000 Christian denominations in the world right now. We're not divided up. Gee, there's no problem. Okay? And, of course, what happened when this walk, as is demonstrated in the past 20 years, pretty soon we begin to divide ourselves up. I think this is very sad. And my point is I don't want to be part of it. I know... I'm not ignorant of my responsibility in this walk. And I don't want to stand before my God playing any part in dividing His people. So please, let's stop talking about it from the pulpits and start doing it. Sorry. And of course, the other accusation, which is kind of springs off the other ones, of course, is his anti-Torah passages, his alleged anti-Torah passages, particularly in the book of Galatians and Romans and Ephesians and Colossians, particularly in those books. Okay, how many times have you heard something like, "Well, in the book of Galatians, it says," okay? Now that's an evolutionary way of saying, okay, never mind. But those are the ones we generally quote. Okay. And so, when you read the background of these accusations, you see that these guys that are making these accusations understand that when Paul was first converted, he was very much for the Torah. You can't read the book of Acts and not see that, my friends. You know what I'm talking about. How many times is Paul brought before the powers that be to have to defend himself against their accusations that he's teaching against the Torah? How many times does he defend himself and say, if you will, if I can say it in a nutshell, no, I did not. Right? No, I did not. As a matter of fact, they had to bring what? False witnesses. Why do you bring forth false witnesses? Because you don't have any true witnesses. So you bring forth the false. So he's constant. So they understand that. Their accusations is that later on in his ministry, when he's traveling through, that this is when he turned against the Torah. Was in his ministry up into, if you will, the uttermost parts of the earth, into Italy and Rome and Athens, etc. Now here's the problem with that. Once again, every New Testament historian that I know of, and I'm going to give you a window of time because they don't all agree on the exact year, but every New Testament historian I know of agrees that particularly these four books were written between 52 and 59 A.D., Galatians, Romans, Colossians, and Ephesians, written before 52 and 59 A.D. And all these guys also basically agree that the book of Acts was completed somewhere around 63 A.D. Is anybody starting to see the problem here already? Because they're saying that in the book of Acts, Paul seemed to be keeping the Torah and was for the Torah. It was when he went to Galatia and Rome and etc. when he turned against the Torah. But the book of Acts was completed after these letters were written. not before. The book of Acts records Paul's visits to Galatia, Rome, Ephesus, and so forth, and no mention whatsoever. So we got a time problem here. We got anachronisms and things like that involved in the text, because these things were written, the book of Acts was completed after these other things were completed. So that does not hold water either. Obviously, one of their accusations is that he was hated by the other apostles and disciples because he was against the Torah. That would be a reason for the other disciples and apostles not to like him. They were speaking against the Torah. We're going to deal with that in a few minutes. I want to deal with two other things real quick and we'll move on. Paul was arrogant. That's another accusation. And anybody that knows anything about New Testament history or understanding thought processes, one of the means by which we know or have a pretty good idea of who wrote a certain book is by the way they teach. Everybody has a particular way of speaking. Everybody has a different grammatical style. There's a lot of historians that believe, for example, that Jeremiah wrote 1st and 2nd Kings. Why? Because Jeremiah's writing style seems to be the king's writing style. So that's the reason why. Everybody has a certain thing about them. We don't have cookie cutter penmen of the scripture. They all have a unique way of expressing their personality through these things. And that helps historians identify who wrote this and who wrote that. And the reality is, Paul comes from Tarsus. We don't have time to get into, but he was arrogant. That is a reality. But being arrogant is not a sign that you're a false apostle. Arrogance is a personality trait. And it's a relative one at that. Some people say, well, that person's arrogant. From their point of view, they're just confident. So it's a relative thing. Just because you think someone's arrogant, they're not running around going, I'm arrogant. They're just very confident. It comes out that way. So arrogancy is a relative term. It's a personality trait. And Paul was indeed arrogant. We can quote a lot of passages. But that helps New Testament historians identify him as being the author of this book, of this writing, and this passage because of his writing style. Now, I'm just going to give you my opinion right now, because there's all kinds of arguments and debates over who wrote the book of Hebrews. Okay? Gee, we've never heard that one before. Okay? Who wrote the book of Hebrews? So we have all kinds of ideas and candidates for the author of the book of Hebrews. I'm going to suggest this possibility. I'm going to suggest the possibility that the reason why we can't come to a conclusion as to who wrote it is because as you read through the Greek text of this, doesn't always come out in the English, but as you read through the Greek text of the book of Hebrews, you see different kinds of grammatical writing styles. You see different kinds. So certain passages for some people seem to be Pauline, if I can use that word, in the nature of the way the grammar is expressed. Other passages seem to indicate that possibly Barnabas or someone like that wrote the book of. Some passages seem to hint of Peter once in a while. I'm just giving you my opinion. I believe that several different authors produced the book of Hebrews. Far be it from just to use a little common sense. Why do we only have to have one author of a particular? Does that violate some kind of thing written in stone in the first century that only one author can write the book? Okay. My contention is that there were several authors of the book of Hebrews, all having different grammatical styles, and that's why we can't come to a conclusion on who was the single author that wrote the book of Hebrews, because there was not a single author. That's my opinion. And so that's part of his nature, is being very arrogant, because Paul comes from Tarsus, a very highbrow, part Jewish, part philosophical, very a city of the intellectual elite. Some of you know who the intellectual elite are. And yet, guess what? One of the accusations, now this was one that was new, okay? Even though I have a series called Words Mean Things, and I address this relationship in the Bible between the word that's translated as hell and Paul's name. Okay? They both come from the same root. They both came from the same parent root. Shin, Aleph, Lamed. Okay? That's the root of Paul's name, and that's the root of what many times in the Bible is translated as hell, Sheol. You all know the words, Sheol and Shaul. Okay? And the same background is used for Sha'alu Shalom Yerushalayim, which means pray for the peace of Jerusalem. Okay? Actually, technically in Hebrew, it would be ask for the peace of Jerusalem. And the reason why those are all coming from the same parent root is because of the meaning of the parent root. Not the meaning of the variety when in the kind, but the meaning of the kind. See, the Word of God works just like creation does. A parent root is a kind. And you can get variety out of that kind, but no kind changes into another one. That's evolutionary thought. But different kinds of variety can come from the same parent root. The idea of Shin Aleph Lamed is to remove from one place and put into another. So all its variety of how it's going to be translated, depending upon the vowel structure, will determine whether it's translated as ask or desire. If I ask you something, I'm removing information from you, Mike, to me. That's why I'm asking you. So that's why it's translated as ask. Paul's name actually means to desire. Shaul means to desire something. Well, if I desire something from you, I'm removing something from you and to me. And of course, the concept of Sheol is removing from one place and put into another. So the actual word itself does not tell you where you go. Okay? It only says something's removed from one place and put into another. Okay? And so, let me move along and get as much as I can in. I really have to get to this before I finish. I'm not going to go through the rest of the Paul stuff. But I want to quote this verse. 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 15 and 16. You're all familiar with this passage. It says, "An account that the long-suffering of our Master is salvation, even as our beloved brother Paul, also according to the wisdom given unto you, hath written unto you." Now, I don't know about you, but when I hate somebody, and I don't know anybody that I hate anyway, but play along. When I hate somebody, I don't call them my beloved brother. Do you, Sarah? Do you call someone your beloved sister? Okay, if you hate them. Okay? And so there's a problem here, because the accusation is that all the other disciples and apostles hate Paul because Paul's teaching against the Torah. But yet in 2 Peter, this is their answer. It says that he's their beloved brother Paul. And of all people, Peter says it. The only one that's recorded that has a problem with Paul, some friction, you know what passages I'm talking about, is the only one that is the one who calls him his beloved brother Paul. But they have an answer to this, and this is their answer. That the second epistle of Peter should also be removed from the text. So now we don't have a spleen, we don't have a bladder, we don't have a pancreas, okay? We just took the lungs out, we just got a dead body that we're working with here, okay? Because the answer is to keep removing things, and if you use the same modus operandi, if you will, the same MO, the same background, once you start doing that, you're just going to have a book with holes all over the place. That's all you're going to have. And I'm not saying there isn't anything in there that shouldn't be there. That's my point. I'm saying the reason why it's scattered all over the place and most of the Bible can be removed using this MO is because we don't get together and discuss these things. We spend more time writing things against each other than we do for each other. And that's the problem, is if we could come to, we're designed to know all these things if we come together. Then he goes on, and this is what I want to close with, and says, he teaches things that are hard to be understood, which they that are unlearned and unstable rest as they do the other scriptures unto their own destruction. The key word there is that because they don't understand Paul, and because they're unlearned and unstable, the result is their own destruction. Now the reality is, and we'll cover this more next time, the reality is, if you go back and you read the Old Testament over and over and over and over again, in the prophets and Deuteronomy, we are told why God's people are always destroyed. Because they did not keep the commandments of their God. You shall surely perish. Same word used there. So whatever these people are thinking about Paul, they don't understand what he's saying. Whatever their conclusion is leading to their own destruction. That's been consistent from the very beginning. People, God's people are always destroyed because they turn away from the commandments of God. It leads to their own destruction and corruption. Okay, now, that's my time.